Hey everybody, Simon Rattner here. Welcome to The Checkout. It's also a podcast, and you should have subscribed to it already on iTunes and Stitcher. After all, you were named the best jazz podcast of 2017, according to Jazz Times. Thanks, Jazz Times. I appreciate that. And we have a very special show. What you're listening to right now is one of the more important musicians, American musicians of the last century, Cecil Taylor. And he left us recently. We are all heartbroken. Everyone probably in the not only jazz community, but lovers of music of all kinds worldwide. Today, I dug up a conversation I had with the one and only Jason Moran, who dedicates a lot of his success to the artistry of Cecil Taylor. And we get really deep into that and explore how Jason Moran was influenced by Cecil Taylor's approach to creation and piano playing on so many levels, not only just physically, but conceptually and spiritually and everything else. And as Jason Moran says, it's good for you. Cecil Taylor is good for all of us, and we will miss him. Sitting here with the Jazz Artistic Director of the Kennedy Center, also MacArthur Fellow, pianist and composer extraordinaire, Jason Moran. The five spot is where Cecil Taylor did turn the jazz world on its ear, according to the great writer Amiri Baraka in 1957-1959. And what I understand, one of your favorite Cecil Taylor recordings of all time comes from that era. His rendition of a Cole Porter song.
Yeah, that's right. It does come from that era. Because, you know, the way...
Love for Sale.
Love for Sale. It's a great tune. And people play it one way most of the time. And here was a man who was like, well, you know, it's also another way to play that, right? Let me just show you how. That was healthy for me to hear, because for some reason when I was growing up, I thought that, oh, when you play a standard, then it has to kind of like adhere to these A, B, and C. And maybe for most people it does, and that's cool, but not for everybody. It's like if a native German speaker arrives in South Carolina and hears English for the first time and then starts to say, oh, well, how will I pronounce those words? Like grits, you know, you know, or sidewalk, you know. If they attempt it, then it comes out with a bit of an accent on it. And so I feel like Cecil really shows us where his accent is and how he pronounces these phrases. And for some people, they can't see the relationship to the melody. But I think for us who have like listened to his language for long enough, we say, oh, okay, so it's there, and it's there. And even how he writes his music down, you know, is not in the, it's its own language of how he gives his graphic score.
Thank you. What was your entry point to the music of Cecil Taylor, Jason Moran?
I think when I was in high school, I first started hearing the idea of a Cecil Taylor. My father had some of his records in his record collection. And so there was a stream of pianists who were kind of like, you know, like the Herbie Hancocks and Chick Corea's, et cetera. But then there was another thread, which was like Mujal, Richard Abrams, Cecil Taylor, like this other thread was happening too. And they were very prominent. They all had equal slots in my father's record collection. So when I got to New York in 93, I can't remember what year it was, maybe 94, 95, I was heard about the Cecil Taylor concert happening downtown in Soho. I get down to Houston Street and I'm like, where is it, you know? And what they had done was Cecil and the dancer Min Tanaka had blocked off a whole street. Cecil Taylor's piano was on a stage in the middle of the street, and they used the street as the stage. And the audience just stood on the sidewalk and watched this. I remember standing on a fire hydrant watching this performance. And I was like, this is why I moved to New York. You know, I moved to New York because something like this happens, you know. And it was the middle of the day. It was like 2 p.m, I felt like. This is my memory of it. And that was when I was like, oh, this man that makes music and makes sound and uses space this way and is this free, I got to see this as much as I can, you know. The records, I love the records, but man, seeing Cecil Taylor perform live, that was a real charge. And so, and seeing that kind of original a performance with a, you know, a dancer and a pianist on the street in New York City, that just opened up the world for me.
Cecil seemed to really respect your teacher, Jackie Byer.
Mm, mm-hmm. Jackie would brag, like, yeah, Cecil Taylor used to come see me play. Because they were up in Boston at the same time. And so the first time I met Cecil Taylor at the North Sea Jazz Festival, when it was in The Hague, Netherlands, I said, you know, it's a pleasure to meet you. I'm a student of Jackie Byard. And he said, stop right there. You know, and he said, there's not one person who knew more about the piano than Jackie Byard. You know, and like he, you know, he just, that was like on the front of his mind, like this sentence and this thought about my teacher. So yeah, Cecil, yeah, I think he had a great respect for Jackie. And every time Cecil and I meet, we talk about piano players, and he's always kind of like, have you heard of Oscar Denard? And, you know, like these kind of obscure players who had immense amount body of knowledge of the instrument, because that seems to be one of many places that Cecil departs from, you know, like what is technique? What is the instrument? What is it as a mechanism? You know, what is it as a kind of like a prism that musicians sit in front of and then are able to explore the world with. That's what I feel like I've heard every time I've heard Cecil play or watched him or talked to him, is that he, you know, he's always in prism mode, you know.
Do you think the world, or shall I say even jazz community, has caught up to the music and legacy of Cecil Taylor?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say that my generation and the people that I hang out with, maybe it's a certain tribe, we know who our grandmaster is, you know? And not everybody's in the same tribe. Jazz community hasn't even caught up to John Coltrane. And John Coltrane has long been passed away. They, you know, I think there are ideas that musicians have planted in music and code so long ago that we haven't been able to decipher yet. So even though we might laud a John Coltrane, we laud him up to a certain point publicly, you know, and, you know, or we laud a Miles Davis up to a certain point too. And then
yeah, there's a little bit of two-faced listening to John Coltrane, right?
Like, but these are artists who continue to move forward, who don't settle themselves into one aspect over and over again. And they become, for me, the best models of how a creative person can live. You know, you make extreme sacrifices by also moving like that, too. So, you know, I don't even think it's about necessarily catching up. The man plays something unlike anyone else in the world. You just gotta love that. And there are a lot of people who sit down and play things very similar to one another. But Cecil Taylor is a true original, and it's very rare that we get to witness someone like him. He really brought a lot to the table. He brought a lot of questions for people to contemplate. And for pianists, he just really, you know, he opened up a world of sound that we still contemplate. I know when I make a phrase and I make a body movement, who I'm referencing.
Now bring you Jason Moran's performance celebrating Cecil Taylor from the Five Spot to the World, recorded at Harlem Stage in 2015.
I met Cecil Taylor first time in Berlin around 2001. I played a concert in a club called, forgot the name, but afterwards I thought I had done something special. I looked at the bar and Cecil Taylor was sitting there, and I went and said, "Hello." He said, I had the piano like this, piano on the low stick. And he said, "Why did you have the piano on the low stick?" I said, "Well, they said it'd be better for the radio. I was young." He said, "Your sound is too big to have it on the low stick. Always have it all the way open." So I'm gonna open it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jason Moran's original composition, channeling the brilliant Cecil Taylor in performance at Harlem Stage. Cecil Taylor from the Five Spot to the World.
Cecil Taylor, what does he mean to America?
Well, Cecil represents the idea that America can improve. You know, that it actually has work to do and that it can improve, and that the ideas in his music, I feel, seem to represent all the questions that we have about where the state of the country is, as this place is constantly in evolution mode and sometimes even seems to be backpedaling. But there's something that what Cecil does, by sometimes in the dense nature of the work and sometimes in the pure clarity of one single phrase at the top of the piano, that really show us where the light is, you know? And the pure physicality and the work that it takes to make that happen. It actually is not nothing that you can just contemplate. You actually have to work at it. And so when you watch a Cecil Taylor performance, I think what he teaches us is that effort is good for you, you know? That strength is good for you. That movement is good for you. That density is good for you, you know? That clarity and reading is good for you. These things, I feel, come out of every note that he plays, and they represent what, you know, America hopefully is striving for.
Speaking with Jason Moran on the checkout. If it weren't for Cecil Taylor, do you think that you would have the courage or audacity to work with artists like an Adrian Piper or a Joan Jonas?
Like I said, seeing that concert with Cecil, like a person who I identified as a musician, kind of purely as a musician, but seeing him work that freely with a dancer in that way was... it kind of shattered my expectations about what a jazz musician was supposed to do, you know, and the kinds of interactions you could have. He really, like, changed the notion for me about who you could work with or who could be on the bandstand, that it wasn't just musicians that should be on the bandstand. But Cecil also exhibits this kind of bravery consistently. It's always been there. It's, you know, it's like it's never faltered. It's like... it's the one whose movement people have to eventually join because they're like, oh, well, you've been saying it all along. And I guess I wasn't ready. You know, and that part, you know, how, I mean, I remember just at the beginning of my career, some of the things that I would hear people say, you know, that if I hadn't, you know, like a person like a Cecil or Jackie Byard, any of these people who kind of really chose the grain wisely, you know, and sometimes it was really against the grain. That by
like really, really against the grain.
Yeah, but for me the grain was always my grain was formed by Thelonious Monk, and that is against the grain too. People seem to act like they like it, but I still have suspicions about them. Or even Duke Ellington. I think Duke Ellington is a bizarre musician, and somehow he was able to sweet talk everybody into getting his word out and making this crazy music that he made. So for me, the grain was always a little bit jagged. That's what you were supposed to feel. Thelonious Monk teaches me that. Like, the grain is gonna always cut your hand a little bit. And so the way the people that I kind of followed and studied with and performed with, they also think of the grain the same way, all the way up to a Steve Coleman or Greg Osby or Cassandra Wilson or Sam Rivers or Charles Lloyd or Wayne Shorter, you know. You know, what do we really think about how Wayne's band is playing? They are beautifully bizarre, beautiful, you know, but they are not showing us footprints like we heard in 1963. And, you know, also I think for musicians, they can't contain that kind of passion. They have no other way but to exhibit it this way. And I love people like that. And Cecil represents the best of that.
I don't know if you know this. I don't even know if I told you this, Jason Moran. I saw your Joan Jonas premiere at the Dia Beacon.
All right.
Where, I don't know, there was probably like 24 people there. Mm. I mean, really, it was not a lot of people.
Yeah.
But your stage was the equivalent of an indoor ballpark. I don't know. It was like the most massive garage space I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And there you are playing some solo piano. Mm-hmm. And Joan is doing, I don't even know how to describe what she's how she's making use of that space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And by the end of the show, you play, he takes off his coat and leaves. And the garage door opens in the back, like almost 300 yards down in this massive garage. And it is like, talk about ecstatic music, sort of channeling what Cecil does. That was one of the most ecstatic artistic experiences I've ever had in my life. I was weeping. Like I was out.
Right. Yeah, and great performances hopefully have that kind of impact on people.
I think Joan Jonas was like carrying around a stuffed wolf with like a giant screen in the background and had these giant like hoops that she was dancing in. I don't even like.
Oh, it's a good memory. Yeah, that's good. That's it. Yeah, it was. Well, that's also the thing is, you know, like there are artists out here who have developed language over decades and decades, and they keep refining this language to a degree that I think for maybe some of the general public has no idea that this other language is being developed, you know. Cecil, of course, is also a part of this canon, or Anthony Braxton, or Muhal, you know, like, or, you know.
Muhal Richard Abrams.
Yeah, Muhal Richard Abrams. And so there are musicians and artists and writers who continue to kind of like scratch, you know, in the ground and like, oh, well, let me erase that. Now maybe I can make it move like this. And that kind of shaping, when people come into contact with it, it's pretty overpowering. It's really potent, you know, especially for artists who have been dedicated to that style or that kind of manipulation of language, whether it's in sculpture or whether it's in literature or whether it's in music. When they get to that point where they're a master of how to manipulate it and you then all of a sudden get hit in the face with it, it's good for you.
Yeah.
It's good for you.
It's like your body changes almost on a chemical level.
That's right. That's right. Thank you. I remember, like, for 1 year on my birthday, when the Iridium used to be at right by Lincoln Center up on 60th Street or whatever, 60 whatever. And my wife, or my girlfriend back then, she's not my wife,
but Alicia Hall.
Alicia said, let's go. I'm going to take you out to see a concert. We went to see Cecil play. And Cecil was playing with a quartet. And I was like, oh, man, I love this girl. You know, she chose the right date, you know, to take me out on. And so we sat there, you know, I don't know. We may have been 22, 23, maybe, you know. And we listened to Cecil play. And I remember, like, being overwhelmed by this quartet he had. I can't remember even who else was playing with him. But I remember being so overwhelmed by it that as we left and as we walked, you know, across the plaza at Lincoln Center, I just remember, like, hearing, like, all the sounds, you know, were, like, just still, like, ricocheting off of the inside of my brain. You know, like, just, I don't know, there was something about, like, how, you know, music can leave an imprint on people that can't be quantified by, like, then we take you to, you know, get a brain scan and now we know how meaningful this was to you. But Cecil traditionally has been able to pull together these performances that for me, like, really leave fingerprints on my mind. That was one, you know. Another was seeing him and Max Roach perform at Columbia University outside. For some reason, for a year, they had, like, this jazz festival on the lawn at Columbia University. And the final concert one night was Cecil Taylor and Max Roach. And they had played the long set, and then they asked for an encore, of course, and Cecil came out and played this ballad. I don't know what ballad it was, but I was just like, you know, he slowed it down for me. And it made sense. It was unbelievable. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think Cecil's one of the first so-called conceptual jazz artists?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, because...
I mean, Duke Ellington was writing songs about trains and stuff, so it goes back way, but in a way, he sort of explodes the paradigm and tradition in such a way that it takes you completely out of it, almost into the universe of sound.
Yeah, you know, but you know what's also important to kind of pull back on is that so I think artists like that, they just make, you know? And there's not a relationship of like, oh, this is against or with. This is just what it
it's
is,
just what it
you
is.
Know? And are we to assume that the listening public is actually normal, you know? No, most people are pretty out of their minds, you know, even the person who does the most mundane job. Everybody kind of has a quirk about them. And so I don't even know if there's a, just because something is marketed a certain way as the normal jazz does not necessarily mean it's good. And just because something is marketed like this is the out or avant-garde thing doesn't necessarily mean it's good either, or bad, or for both. And kind of pulling back from all of those kind of marketing ploys that they put, you know, kind of barriers around certain styles of music, or uptown scene or downtown scene, or, you know, East Coast or West Coast, or, you know, Scandinavia, or, you know.
Just trying to contextualize it with language, there's always pitfalls, right?
It really is. And I think for some artists, it doesn't really help their cause. But for real artists, they defy that all the time. They have long careers and they continue to make the work that they need to make to live. I mean, people do this stuff, you know, not just for fun. They do it because they have to live. And Cecil, by virtue of him even touching the piano for an audience, means that his will is really survived by his relationship with his instrument and his relationship with his audience and his relationship with, you know, all the people who impact his life. And that's a real testament. He's a real mirror and he's a real helpful resource for all of us who, young musicians, younger than me even, who kind of look for a longevity in the career. He has shown us a way.
Why don't you share a Cecil tune that immediately comes to mind that you want people to hear?
What I also think is great about Cecil is his relationship to other piano players. You know, piano players have like this kind of unsaid thing where we really don't like each other. You know, like drummers really love talking to each other about drum stuff. And bass players, you know, but within the rhythm section community, maybe piano players are the most... we kind of get a bad rap.
You kind of like stand back and stroke your like facial hair, right?
We all think we're very smart. Cecil did an amazing recording with Mary Lou Williams. And it's a real meeting of two minds, you know, two minds about sound. And anything from that recording, that live recording, is a real treasure. Just to hear kind of like, I mean, that's how I like to try to live my life, was like these combinations of two sounds. I used to like play video games and listen to two records at once because I had two record players, and I'll place the mixer, the fader right in the middle between, you know, so that I could hear equally both records at the same time. And so, but Cecil did it on purpose in public with Mary Lou Williams, you know, and it's that kind of love that I appreciate. And it's a great recording for anybody to listen to.
Cecil Taylor with Mary Lou Williams. What two records would you put on at the same time while you're playing what video game?
Well, mostly I was playing Mortal Kombat in the early 90s. But I would put on, do I have the record here? It's a Cecil Taylor record called, it's a silver record called, is it called New Collective? You know? And then I would put on like Train Sunship at the same time. You know, I'd have to double check the name of that Cecil record. But yeah, I could see myself doing that. I remember doing that very clearly.
So, I mean, you have mashups today where you can do that.
That's
and it's
true.
Very calculated.
That's true. It is. Yeah.
Did anything like work naturally more than others?
No, that all sounded like a bunch of noise, you know, good noise, you know, but that was a noise that I was trying to get accustomed to so that then when I made something that sounded like that, I wouldn't be scared of it. But I remember one time meeting with George Lewis, and he was showing me his piano. That
George Lewis, the professor, ethnomusicologist from Columbia University.
Yeah. But George had this piano that would respond to how a pianist played. So it was two pianos in the room. I would play on one, and the data from my piano would go into this other player piano. and it would respond back. And it would play these strange things. And I remember one time he played me a recording of, I think, Muhal Richard Abrams playing with this piano. And I said, oh, that sounds like one Cecil Taylor. Like them together was getting to like this thing that Cecil's able to kind of like to calculate and spit out the data in his hands. He really shows us the dichotomy about how his hands move like in this kind of opposite motion sometimes, you know, going out away from each other, away from the body, coming into the body together. And this thing is, you know, or when the hands work together to go in one direction. It's, you know, he has such a good physique because he's long been getting his workout at the piano.
Well, Jason Moran, thank you so much for talking about one of our heroes in this music, Cecil Taylor. Cool, man.
Great. All right. Thanks, brother.
That's Cecil Taylor with Mary Lou Williams. We thank Jason Moran for sharing his thoughts about the Grandmaster. We will all miss him. The amazing, the phenomenal, the one and only Cecil Taylor. The Checkout is a podcast, and definitely make sure to subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And even better yet, we really want our listeners to give us a review on Facebook, on iTunes, and on Stitcher. Just helps us get the word out about the program, increase its visibility. If you think the work that we do is important, please share it with your friends. I'd like to give a special shout out to our production intern, Anthony Nieves. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.